Welcome to the Automate and Grow podcast, brought to you by Cloud Advisory.
All right, welcome. This is episode 10 of the Automate and Grow podcast. And today I'm joined by my friend Steve Hoffman, also known as Captain Hoff in some circles. And Steve's got a couple of really exciting things going on. One is he is the founder and CEO of Founderspace. And Founderspace was initially a co-working space, an accelerator, and an incubator in San Francisco, but he's going to probably tell us about all the other cool places they're in. And he's also the author of a book that is also around digital and, well, more product innovation, I think. And we'll talk to Steve about that as well, which is how to get, I'm going to totally get this wrong again, how to get elephants to fly. Is that right?
It is close.
I mix it up every time. I'm so sorry.
No, you're almost right on. It's called Make Elephants Fly.
Make Elephants Fly. I apologize. I think in a previous conversation with Steve, I referred to his book as Dancing with Elephants, but...
Not dancing.
Not right either. Okay. So, Make Elephants Fly. So, thank you, Steve. I really appreciate, despite all my foibles, you joining the podcast, because I think it's always exciting to talk to you, and you always got fun stuff going on.
Yeah, I do.
So I guess the first thing I wanted to talk to you about was, tell me about what's going on with Founderspace, and what is Founderspace, and where are you guys, and what are you guys up to?
So Founderspace is an incubator accelerator. Our headquarters are here in San Francisco. We've been around 6 years, working with hundreds of startups all over the world. And recently, in the past 2 years, we've been expanding internationally. So right now we have over 50 partners in 22 countries.
Oh my God, wow. And
yeah,
it's, I had no idea it was that big. That's amazing.
And we're particularly big in China. So we have set up our offices in Beijing, Shanghai, and their biggest college town, Wuhan. And we're about to launch in 3 more cities in the next few months.
Oh my God, that's incredible. And then are these... So your relationship with those other cities, are these actually facilities that you're opening, or do you have partnerships? Like, how are you doing that? Because it seems so rapid.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
They are Founderspace incubators and accelerators, and it seems rapid, but you know, I've been at it for 2 years in China.
Oh, wow.
So it didn't happen overnight. Nothing ever does. But we have really strong partners there, and China's a huge market. Mm-hmm. You know, the U.S. and China are the biggest markets in the world. Launch a startup in either of those markets and you have the potential to grow like crazy.
Yeah. And so what type of companies are you working with? Like, is it across the board, or are you kind of focused on one particular segment? Like, what are you seeing in each of these markets?
We work with all types of startups. So they're primarily tech startups, you know, startups that are using new technology to either disrupt an existing market or create a brand new market. And it's pretty amazing. So we cover like lots of AI startups, big data, tech, blockchain, you know, biotech, you name it.
Oh my God. Our conversation could go on for hours. So we might have to do this in a couple segments. I have a bad feeling.
Sure.
Because you just hit on some really exciting individual segments that we could probably talk, you know, really interesting things about. But so if I'm a startup, I would approach Founderspace. Is that how it works, or what's the process that I would get involved in?
So many different ways. So startups apply. A lot of startups apply on our website, and it depends where they want to go. You know, if they want to work with us here in Silicon Valley, they would apply to our Silicon Valley program. If they wanted to work in Beijing, they would apply.
Okay.
To Beijing.
I think we're both better. All right. Sorry.
Okay. Cool.
So we were saying how startups can apply and. Regardless, it depends on the market, and it sounds like you have a broad range of companies that you're working with. What are some of the exciting companies that you're kind of juiced about and interested in that are maybe either in your accelerator program or the incubator?
Oh, we just, there's been some amazing ones. So we just had a startup graduate that is called Ecubot. And I really love the guys. They're super smart founders. They come to Stanford and Berkeley, and their concept was they wanted to do the first ETF, exchange-traded fund, that is powered by AI.
Oh, wow.
So basically, they launched it right after they graduated. They launched the Ecubot, and it went ballistic. I mean, they were
That's
raising
crazy.
Tens of millions of dollars. They've had They were written up in Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, you know, every major publication, because they were the first. And what I always tell startups is you got to do something that captures people's attention. You can't be like everybody else. You can't be like a little bit better than everybody else. If you're a little bit better than somebody who's already out there, you've already lost.
Makes sense.
Already have momentum. They usually already have funding. They're already going. You're not gonna pass them up. You're not even gonna catch up usually. So these guys, you know, what I look for in great startups is when they have to do one of two things, or they do not break through. And the one thing is either they have to be exponentially better than any of the competition. Like, you know, Google search engine wasn't first to market.
Right.
They were like 19th or something like that. But their search engine worked, and all the other ones were crap. Yeah, they were crappy. They didn't work. They just, you know, they didn't have a page ranking algorithm like Google did. So Google just passed them all up. The only other way, if you're not going to be exponentially better, and to be exponentially better than somebody already in the market is hard.
Right.
You know, because everybody's trying to be really good. They're not, you know, if they're out there, they're trying to do the best. The other way is you just have to do something new and different. And that's what Ecubot did. There was nobody else out there with an AI-powered ETF, and they were first to the market. So they got all the attention to build their brand.
That's amazing.
And as you know, building your brand is the hardest part, getting people to even pay attention to you. You know, there's so much noise out there.
Very
true. Nobody pays attention unless you're able to do something exceptional that just stands out.
That makes sense, yeah. So in China, you know, you started talking about it. Unfortunately, I think you broke up a little bit, but you were talking about how in the U.S., it's kind of like you're the government, whereas in China, the government's involved in everything that you're doing. So kind of tell me about a little bit about that, your experience, because it always kind of fascinates me. It's still a communist country, but they have almost approach to free market economics that's kind of very unique and seems to be working, but, you know, I guess it depends on your definition of working. But yeah, I'm curious about entrepreneurship there and how that works.
Sure. So in China, it is very hard to do anything without the government being involved. First of all, I mean, even to do business, like as Facebook and Google knows, you have to work with the government.
Right.
Otherwise, it's not going to they're just going to shut you out entirely. Second, the government is heavily involved in the startup area. They have funneled a lot of money into this space, and they're pushing really hard to help Chinese startups succeed. Because we all know doing a startup is really hard.
For sure.
Building an ecosystem is really hard. Mm-hmm. You know, and doing that across a massive country with 1.4 billion people.
Oh my God, yeah.
It's not easy. You know, literally half the population of China is below the poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other half is middle class, you know, or doing extremely, extremely well. And there is a lot of venture capital, but there's this huge dichotomy in China. And so the government's goal is to keep that country stable, you know, while moving people out of poverty. You know, their goal is to move them up the ladder. And it's still a huge goal. They're like only 50% of the way there.
Right. You still have like 700 million people.
Yeah, a million people to actually lift up out of poverty.
Wow.
You know, that's not a small number
that's
of people.
That's incredible when
you
think about
those
it.
People are really poor. I mean, they're not by U.S. standards poor. I mean, they
like
are
just
really poor. Yeah. And so, to understand China, it's very, very different. You know, and it's a very top-down a hierarchical structure. So everything in China is almost like you're going back in time to one of the old dynasties, you know, where everything was a top-down hierarchical system. It's still
it's like a caste system.
It's not exactly like a caste system because they don't have the castes.
Oh,
like
there's
in
not
India.
Tiers. Like
yes,
okay.
Everybody, you know, people aren't discriminated against because
Got
of
it.
The untouchables,
oh,
right?
Okay.
Like
oh,
India.
That's right. Yeah,
but
good distinction.
But you definitely, if like in China, I'll just give you a few examples. You know, if there's a government official there, everybody makes sure to court the government. You know, when I do a startup here in the U.S., my own startup, I've done three of them. When I do Founderspace, I guess you could call it, it's my fourth.
Yeah.
When I go And I don't even think about the government. Right. I don't meet with government officials at all. I just do my business. In China, literally, when you go to start your company, you are engaging with the government.
So do they have like local officials that are like startup bureaucrats or something? Is that kind of how it works?
They have their startup bureaucrats.
Wow.
And you have to go, you know, and if you're smart, you will meet with them because they have a lot of power. Hmm. They have a lot of resources. Basically, what the government says happens. So if a government official says, don't do that because we don't like it, that type of business, you have to stop. I mean, you literally, if you don't stop, you will be stopped.
Wow, that's really interesting.
And so people are very cognizant of, you know, of making sure that they're on the right side of the government when they do everything. It's a very different mentality.
That's so different because like anybody can go start a business here. They just go register a company. There's not really much oversight. Like, I think you obviously have to keep track of things and there's kind of some best practices, but it's not like anyone's sitting there saying, you know, you're going to win or lose, right? It's kind of like they're much deeper in. That's interesting.
It's very interesting. You know, even the biggest players in China, like Jack Ma, the head of Alibaba, you know, or Pony Ma, the head of Tencent, which runs WeChat, those guys, they have to work with the government.
Wow.
They are always listening to the government. They're always meeting the government. I was invited to a special meeting with them and with Tim Cook and a bunch of other, like, Tim Cook was, you know, with the premier of China. And we all had to sit in a room and it was like a dialogue. And they were basically pitching the premier of China on their business.
Oh my God, that's so crazy.
And giving feedback as to what they wanted in their business while being very respectful.
There's no escape velocity, it sounds like. It's not like they're just trying to boost you up and let you out into the universe. It's like, it sounds like an ongoing engagement almost.
They're a partner in your business.
Wow. And then how does that look? Like, is it they're a partner because of taxation or is it more?
No, that's America. In America, it's just tax. But you pay us the money and do what you want as long as you don't break the law, right?
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're a partner in everything you do.
Wow.
Because, well, the media is completely controlled by the government.
Right.
So if you have any sort of social aspect where people are communicating with each other, like WeChat, which is owned by Tencent, you have to implement all the rules. And basically, the government controls every conversation.
Damn,
so
that is crazy.
And they care about what people are saying to each other. They're monitoring everything that's said on all the networks.
Wow.
And that changes your business. And you, and if the government feels like you aren't promoting the interests of the government, which are synonymous there with the interests of the country, then you will be shut down.
That is crazy.
Or taken over.
Wow.
Yes.
So it's such an interesting. And then, like, as an entrepreneur, though, how do things like share ownership, like how do things like disbursements, like pay, like how are those things decided?
Well, it's still a free market economy in the sense that you can just start your company. You hire people for what you're willing to pay them. They have labor rules just like we have in the U.S.
Okay.
But they're no more strict. They're pretty equivalent to what we have here.
Okay.
The thing is that if you want land to expand your factory, if you want to get a prime location, if you want government support now. The companies that the government chooses to back have a huge competitive advantage as opposed to the companies that aren't involved with the government at all. So if you have government backing in your industry, then you're going to and your government backing is stronger than your competitors, you're going to have a lot of opportunities and a lot of advantages that your competitors just don't have in terms of like who you do business with, distribution, advertising, everything. You know, all the state media, all the television, all the radio is controlled by the government.
Wow, it's so fascinating.
Even,
it's crazy.
Yeah, so you want to get your word out there, you got to play ball.
Well, I mean, Steve, you're not a Chinese national, right? So how are
I'm
they,
not.
Yeah, so how are they two foreign entrepreneurs or investors, and like how did you get involved in it? It's really kind of crazy what you're describing. It feels like it would be very much a walled garden, but
it was a total learning experience because doing business in China is like nothing like doing business here. So I went over there, 2.5 years ago, just for fun. I was invited because I do startups to come over there and meet with some key people. I flew out there. I thought, well, this is interesting, but I probably won't do business here. And then I got invited again and then again.
Wow.
And, about 2 years ago, like after half a year, I decided, there's an opportunity right now for me to expand into China. I have these relationships. I'm getting some support. I should just try it. It will be really, I didn't do it for business. I did it because I thought it would be a really interesting experience. But I didn't know what I was doing. I was clueless. So what I did, it's my strategy to do startups and what I tell startups to do. Go in there and make a lot of mistakes, but don't make big mistakes. So because you're going to only learn if you actually just do it. You won't learn just like reading about it or talking to people. You just have to do it. So I started to sign deals, but all my deals were short-term deals.
Okay.
So I didn't sign any long-term deals. I do little deals. We'll do this project together. We'll do that together. How about if we do this? And then as I got to know people and have a relationship and understand how the system works, I started to do bigger and bigger and bigger deals.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I'm still learning, but I could go on for hours about business in China. I will tell you, in America, we tend to do business on a transactional basis.
Right.
Like we look at the company, the reputation, and if it makes sense, we'll do the deal.
Right.
In China, because there's a fundamental lack of trust there, and it's also cultural, people do business based on relationships. They would rather do a deal with you because they like you and because you're friends than any other business consideration.
Interesting. Wow. And then,
yes.
So, we can, to your point, I'm sure I could spend hours picking your brain on this, and I find it very fascinating. I hope people watching do too. So what would, in a nutshell, what sort of advice would you give anyone that's thinking that, hey, I have something that would be huge in China? What kind of advice would you give them, and what would be the first step you think they would have to take?
The first step is you have to go over there.
Okay.
And then you have to meet people. Now, the hard thing about China is you have to meet people and really get to know them, because some people are amazing. I have people in China that I work with who I totally trust. Like I would hand them, the password to my bank account, and I would know that the money would be there when I woke up.
Oh, wow.
Morning. And there are other people in China who you cannot trust at all. They will seem like your friends. They'll seem super nice.
It's like, look over here.
Yeah, and when you turn your back, you'll feel the pain.
Wow,
yeah.
That's crazy.
So how do you know who you can trust and who you can't? That's a really hard thing to do. And then the other thing to do is basically you have to assume, until you really know them, you can't trust anybody. So you have to do your deals in a way that you aren't putting too much out, too much. You aren't risking too much. You aren't exposing yourself to either lie. A lot of people go over there, man, and I've heard the stories. They'll sign joint venture deals. They turn into joint nightmare deals.
Oh, man. Wow. Okay.
Because you're basically partnering with somebody, and if you don't have the right contract in place, you're liable for what that person does.
I'm sure that there's so many nuances with the law and contracts.
That person could
crazy
be taking
different.
Out. They could be taking out debts. They can be buying land with the company money and then selling it and pocketing the money on the side.
Interesting.
I've heard all of these stories from people I know personally.
That's crazy.
And so you have to be really careful how you structure the deals. And you should have like a great lawyer, but even more importantly, like great advisors.
Interesting.
In China.
So I want to switch gears a little bit. And I find this totally fascinating. So I'm sure we could talk more about it specifically. And Founderspace, it's an exciting time for you guys, and it's an exciting model. And I think I mentioned, I'm almost envious of what you're doing. I'm like, wait, why? I should have done something similar. It's such a great space. Just the variety of businesses, and now that you're expanding these markets, really interesting. So if I switch gears a little bit, you wrote your book, and what was kind of like the motivation for writing your book?
So when I sat down to write Make Elephants Fly, the motivation was this. I've done three startups myself Like, I've been in the trenches. I co-founded the companies, the CEO. I know how hard it is. And I know how hard it is to have like this big idea. And the big idea is like the elephant. And then how do you get it off the ground? How do you make that idea fly when it seems like impossible? So with my own experience, and you know, I've had failures and successes and like everything in between. And then the experience of actually sitting down with a lot of different startup founders and watching them go through the process, not just watching them, but actually helping them survive the process of doing a startup. That's what I wanted to capture in the book. I wanted to capture, you know, why do some startups succeed? And actually, I have a lot of case studies in there showing every step they took to be successful.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then also on the flip side, why do certain startups fail? And then I wanted to go through, basically the reasons why they failed and where they messed up.
So you're trying to boil it down to reusable principles that we can kind of learn from, or at least provide examples so that hopefully it lessens, doesn't, you know, I have at least a model, you're saying, of innovation.
Yeah, well, basically, I don't want you to make the mistakes that I have made and that I see all these startup founders make. I want you to make new mistakes because it's your business. There are plenty of mistakes you can, there's plenty of mistakes you can make. You might as well make new ones and not the ones that you can avoid because they've already been made before. Yeah.
So in your model, is it specific to one particular, like I kind of argue right now that all businesses are digital businesses, whether they realize it or not. There's an element of that. And yes, that the number one job of entrepreneurs over the next 10 years, because I think it's going to be incredibly disruptive because there's all these technologies that are at a tipping point. Their number one job is to really understand the customer and figure out how to apply a digital technology to their problem. And I'm curious if your methodology applies only to digital. Is it specific to any particular category, or, you know, what would I learn from?
That's a great question. So, you know, your thesis is right on. So most startup founders become so enamored with their product or the technology that they don't even engage with the customer. They're right. Just like off in their own world, building the thing that they think somebody wants with no validation that, you know, or no data or input there's even a demand for this.
Like a vacuum.
And that's where they're in a vacuum. And that's where a lot of them run into problems because, you know, 99% of the time where you start and where you end are totally different. Mm. Like, it's a huge process. So my view of the world is, you know, you say digital. You know, I would just extend that a little broader to just technology in general.
Technology.
I mean, it can be, and what I mean by that is it could be CRISPR DNA editing. Mm-hmm. It could be nanotechnology. It can be, you know, any sort of technology that gives a startup a huge competitive advantage. So what you want, the technology itself doesn't matter. Like, mm-hmm. I don't care if a startup is a nanotech startup or if they're doing a SaaS platform or a cloud platform or, you know, I don't care what they're doing, but I want to know how they're using that technology in their industry so that when they come into the marketplace, those customers love them, right? The customer's like, oh my God,
now,
this
sense.
Like solves one of the biggest headaches
right.
I've been having. I gotta have this. Or, oh my God, I never thought of that. That's so useful or so cool or so entertaining. You know, I have to use it. I have to try it out.
So you want that like punch where it's like, it's changing the whole equation for the customer. It's like and to your point, it's almost like your own monopoly, right? Like, I think Peter Thiel says that, like, create your own monopoly, which is
he's right on. Yeah, what a monopoly is, essentially, it's like you're first to market with a new product, so you don't have competition, so you have big margins.
Right.
And if you have big margins, you can scale that business. That means you have the profit to grow the business very fast. If your margins start to get squeezed, you move into the commodity category.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to scale when there's a lot of competitors and all you're doing is competing on price. And that is where technology comes in. Like I said, it doesn't matter what technology it is. If it's digital, DNA, editing technology, whatever, as long as it gives you that defensibility and that uniqueness so that you can go in there and kind of dominate that market ahead of everybody else. And if you dominate ahead of people, you know, the power of your brand, The power of maybe you have the network effect or other barriers to entry, we call them unfair advantages. Mm-hmm. Those are what allow you to keep growing even as everybody else piles into the market, because everybody will pile into the market.
Sure.
But if you're doing things right, you will continue to push them aside and then they will go away. Like we all know, like how many search engines do you use? I mean, most people just use Google.
Right. I didn't know there were others anymore.
Yeah, I know. Right? Because they just push them aside. You know, nobody can keep up with the Google brand is so strong that we don't even know if another search engine is good. And we're not going to bother to find out.
Yeah.
Because we know they're constantly, improving. So they're probably better than anybody else.
Right.
It's really hard to leapfrog Google at this point.
So I want to be conscious of your time. So I'll ask you only a few more questions. The one thing
sure.
I was curious about, and I saw a video that you'd put up, and I thought it was really good, by the way. I've probably
Thank
told you.
You
that four times. And the one element was talking about how if you are a larger organization, you have an idea of how even a larger organization can innovate in a way similar to a startup. And I'm wondering if you can kind of just touch on that briefly. And it sounds like that's something that you write about, but that you also consult about maybe. So I was kind of, maybe if you can kind of touch on that a little bit for people that might not be
sure.
in a startup situation, they might be in a larger organization.
Yeah, that's great, because I do a lot of work with big corporations. You know, we just finished a 3-month innovation program with Bosch, the big German
amazing.
Company,
yep.
where we took 11 of their internal teams, their entrepreneurs who had projects, and we took them through the entire startup process. And, we needed to figure out whether those teams had a product that could become a huge business unit, a Bosch. And if it didn't, we wanted to kill them.
Interesting.
Because it's, end of the day, especially in a big company, things can linger. Like these projects can go on forever.
Right.
So I saw it as my personal job, and it was not an easy job.
Yeah,
is to get them to either pivot, get them to prove to me that what they had worked and that there was a huge demand and that they could fulfill it, or to get them to pivot or just kill the project. And to do that in a 3-month period. And a lot of, basically, it's all the stuff I put in my book, Make Elephants Fly, is geared not just towards startup founders, it's geared towards anybody who's innovating, either in a large organization or just on your own or in a small company. You know, the process is fundamentally the same. You go through the same steps when you innovate. But in a large corporation, it's actually more difficult.
Right. Because it's like you have this bureaucratic way of doing it, you have oversight, and there's a demand for profitability. So you're almost talking about a research or a labs approach to innovation. And I'm curious what the key do you think is so that that doesn't get crushed? Because even what you're saying, which is this going to be a big business or not, could crush a project, right? So I'm kind of curious, like, what's the key to success for a large organization to innovate that way?
So the hardest part of innovating in a large organization is that the entrepreneurs, a lot of them, when they're starting out with new ideas, they aren't even allowed to work on it full time.
Right. Yeah.
So they have all these other responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I want you to do this, 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 and this by next week and come back to me with this data. And then they come back next week and go, well, I had to do this and that and this other thing for my other job. And I'm like, well, then you're not, that's really difficult. So the first thing I try to do when I work with any large corporations is get them to basically dedicate that if they're going to have somebody become an entrepreneur inside their company, they have to allow that person to focus on it. It's very hard to do when it's just a part-time side thing. It usually happens, but it happens halfway. And as you and I know, being entrepreneurs, anything you do halfway, you might as well
not. It ain't going to work.
Yeah, it ain't going to work. Yeah. You might as well not have done it.
Right.
That's number one. Number two is a lot of times they'll get buy-in on their idea. Like they'll run a contest. All these big companies run these big contests,
Okay.
And they choose the best idea. Well, usually, as you know, and I know, working with, all these different entrepreneurs, your first idea is almost always sucks. It's like not the right idea. And there's
right.
a reason it sucks, because you don't have much data.
Right.
You just have an idea.
Yep.
And like you haven't gone out, you haven't talked to the customer, you haven't done, market validation, you haven't been through the whole process. You don't even know the pitfalls. You don't know anything. So your original idea is either going to be, it's usually off base to some degree. And most times it's so far off base, you have to change it a lot or just drop it and start over and try something else.
It's really interesting that you're saying that, though, I think, because it almost is like that's a way to re-engage customers, get data for yourself, but make them understand that you're unique and innovative as a company. Just the fact that you're exploring these things is kind of interesting.
Right. So I would push them out of the office into the hands of the customer, like you're saying. I'd be like, you can tell me whatever you want. I can think it's the best idea of the world, in the world. I'm not your customer. You should go re-engage your customers, right? Talk to them, figure it out. They're going to be telling you whether you know this. If this idea isn't one of their top on their top five list of priorities, like the top five things that they absolutely must get done, they're never going to do it.
That's really interesting.
They're never going to buy your product or service. It's like number six doesn't count. We're all so busy, you know?
Wow.
Somebody calls you up, oh, I'll get back to that. That's really nice. That's really cool. I'll get back to it later, you know? And I got these other five things I got to get done.
Right. And it's even like you're saying, like job splitting, it doesn't work. So it's like you've got to figure out where in the customer's mind this might, like how painful is this problem? And is this an opportunity because of that? Like, is there validation of your solution to that problem? So it's an interesting approach. And then
yes.
I think the other thing you mentioned that I thought was actually really interesting was that you emphasized, and this might be more of a statement than anything, but that you can't do this in a big way in a large organization. You've got to have small teams to innovate.
Yes. So small team, if you have a big, it gets bureaucratic. Let's face it. Committees don't make good decisions. Committees move slowly. You need to have small teams and you need to give them the freedom to go out there and experiment. And like I was talking about the contest earlier, a big problem with the contest is that when somebody wins a contest, they think they got it. They think they got the best idea in the world, right?
Yeah.
All they did was they came up with some random idea and other people said, oh, that's probably good.
And then go
figure it
out.
But neither of them had any proof.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of the teams in the company will come back to me and be telling me, well, my boss doesn't want me to change.
Right.
My boss
Peter Principle.
Doesn't, you know, my boss bought into
You're
this.
A threat.
I can't go back to my boss now and tell them I'm not doing this. Mm. My boss will be upset.
Interesting.
I may get, you know,
totally
fired.
A different set of problems.
It's a totally different set in that way. So the fundamental process is the same, but then there's all these other problems within larger companies that have to be dealt with in order for innovation to happen. And that's why a lot of times it just doesn't happen.
Which totally makes sense. So it's an interesting model. I think it's very exciting that it's not just startups, but how do you innovate in a large organization and apply those principles? So it's fascinating. I know we could talk forever about it.
Yes,
and I hope that we can have another conversation. Maybe we can slice off some of these topics because I'm always fascinated when we get together and talk, and I think you have a lot of value to offer.
Sure.
So, and actually, what I should do is next time I come to San Francisco, I will make a point of coming to Founders Space because I want to see it and maybe meet some people there too. So we'll make sure that we
Good.
Do some stuff and record it there maybe. I'm going to wrap up
awesome.
With two questions, and I think I probably,
yes.
the one I usually ask is, how are you changing the world?
In a small way.
That's fine.
So what I do, our mission at Founderspace is pretty simple. A lot of people, we started, like so many other incubators and accelerators here, of bringing startups from all around the world to Silicon Valley. You know, and a lot of accelerators are great here. You know, YC, Y Combinator,
yep.
500 startups. There's some really good accelerators here. We saw that, well, that's pretty crowded. We can do that, but we're just like everybody else. So our fundamental mission became not just to bring people to Silicon Valley, but to bring Silicon Valley to everywhere else in the world. So that's why, you know, I've spent 70% of my time traveling.
Oh, wow.
And
I didn't realize it was that much.
Going around. It's like crazy. Going around, giving talks, meeting startups, you know, working with different governments, not just China, but, you know, I work with Taiwan, I work with Japan, I work in Korea, I work all across Europe. So that is how I'm changing the world. Just, you know, every day I'm out there. I'm learning an enormous amount about how innovation happens, not just here in Silicon Valley, but all around the world. And I'm comparing and contrasting that and sharing that knowledge.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's incredible. So, Steve, I'm going to ask you one more question, and I'd like you to tell us
at the final one.
Yeah, the final one, and then I'd like you to tell us the best way to reach out to you and connect with you.
Sure.
And what we do is I like when I have interesting people on, and I trust that you know a lot of interesting people. So, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to nominate someone that you think should do an episode of Automate and Grow, and that we could learn something interesting from.
Okay. I will connect you with the founders of Ecubot.
Ecubot. Wow, that's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, we talked
about... Because I talked about them.
Yes.
So I will do that on email. They're awesome guys, super smart. And you can have an episode with them.
Fantastic. I would love that. I will take you up on that. Yeah. What's the best way for people to reach out to you and connect with you?
And, okay, you can reach me. My nickname is Captain Hoff. Captain at founderspace.com, captain at founderspace, or just go to founderspace.com, or go to makeelephantsfly.com, either way.
And where can we get your book?
You can get it, go to makeelephantsfly.com. It's right there. It's on Amazon. It's everywhere. It's in every bookstore.
Amazing. Steve, thank you so much. I'm really glad we got
to
connect.
Thank you.
This has been episode 10, so you're like the first into the teens, I think.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I look forward to talking and seeing you soon.
Me too.
Thanks.
Great. Take care.
Great Have a great
on your
day.
Show.
Thanks.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
This has been an episode of the Automate and Grow podcast. Check out other episodes for interesting topics on how to grow, innovate, and automate your business. Subscribe or like us on iTunes, YouTube, Google Play, or on our website at www.automategrow.biz. And get your copy of the book Automate and Grow at Amazon today.